I'm Ian Deary. I'm Director of the Centre for Cognitive Ageing and Cognitive Epidemiology at the University of Edinburgh. And today I'm talking about healthy cognitive ageing. And principally, I'm talking about the research I've done with the Lothian birth cohorts of 1921 and 1936. I've only got a few things to tell you about tonight, to be honest. First of all, I'm going to tell you about the Scottish Mental Surveys of 1932 and 1947. I'm going to then tell you about the Lothian birth cohorts that we've recruited from these surveys. And then I'm going to tell you about four different areas that might be helpful in learning how we best can optimally cognitively age. I'm going to start off with lifestyle factors, and then I'm going to move on to biomedical factors, and then brain imaging, and then genetics as well. Actually, can I just ask, is this feeding back a wee bit, actually? I don't know if your sound man's around, but that'd be fine. I'll try and keep the voice down just now, but okay. So has anybody not heard of these surveys? Okay, that's fine, I'll speak to you. So the talk is based on the Scottish Mental Surveys of 1932 and 1947. So Scotland, in at least this one way, is unique, because nobody has ever done this before. Scotland twice measured the IQ of the entire nation, once in 1932 and once in 1947. So let me tell you about the Scottish Mental Survey of 1932. On Monday, June the 1st, 1932, almost every child born in 1921 and attending school took the same mental ability test using the same instructions at the same time on that day. So on that morning, Scotland tested 87,498 children on the Murray House test number 12. And no country had ever done this before. Scotland was the first one to do it, to get organised, test the entire nation. It turned out it was about 95% of the population, and they published it in 1933 in this book called The Intelligence of Scottish Children. And we managed to find a copy of the test. And here are a few examples. Now, just before we start looking at them, because it's compelling once they're up there. The maximum score you can get on this test was 76. So please remember that. I shall be asking questions later. No, that wasn't a pun. I will be asking questions later. Here are a couple of examples of questions, but there's one down there. You might have to stand up to see it. But there's a few shapes and some numbers, and it says, what number is in the triangle and the square, but not in the circle? There's 11-year-olds sitting this. Okay? Right. So some of you have seen me show this many times before, some not, but I always say the same thing, and it's true. It's still copyright, so I can't tell you what the answer is. Okay. Then they did it all again. 15 years later, Scotland took almost everybody born in 1936 and gave them that same test, the Murray House test, number 12, on Wednesday, the 4th of June, 1947. And that time they tested 70,805 children. And that was the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947. And so Scotland is the only country in the world for whom you can plot the geography of intelligence using population data and not sample data. It just occurred to me as I was preparing my slides for today, I've shown this slide many times, but never before in Glasgow. Now, as a protection, the doors look barred. I come from Lanarkshire, and what I thought I'd do is start off with something not very controversial. I'll show you the average score for Edinburgh and Glasgow out of 76, okay? So these are probably for rather boring reasons of the heavy industry at the time through in the West and the more professional occupations. If you look at the rest of the country, these are the average scores out of 76 for this test. And I used to do the rather glib summary that things get worse as you go west and north of Edinburgh in terms of IQ scores, but that doesn't capture all of the variation. But there is rather predictable socioeconomic probably variation in these children's scores. And I'd worked in intelligence for many years, but never heard of these surveys until the mid to late 90s, when my friend Lawrence Woolley, who's professor of psychiatry at Aberdeen, started asking me questions about something else, and the two of us stumbled towards them. And in fact, the data had all been retained. So the data from the Scottish Mental Survey of 1932 and 1947 had been retained by the body that did them originally, called the Scottish Council for Research and Education. Is anybody here from SCRE tonight, just out of interest? We owe you a lot. So these are the ledgers. So those are the ledgers for the 1932 survey of the children born in 1921. And they're all there except for a few. Fife is missing and Wigton is missing, for example. And these are 1947 ledgers. And let me just show you inside them. So that's a page from the Scottish Mental Survey of 1932. It's from my hometown of Carluke, from the Roman Catholic School. And these are the names, dates of birth, and scores for the children. And this is the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947. Again, same things, schools, etc. Names, date of birth, sex, score out of 76 for the test. Ah, and here's an interesting column here. This is position in the family. And thereby lies a tale, why they did that in the second survey, but not in the first one. Right, so that's it. Any questions about the surveys? Those are the Scottish Mental Surveys in brief form. Okay, is that clear enough? So, it became clear to, originally it was Lawrence Woolley and myself that were researching these, is that the world, of course, is experiencing a demographic change with, very briefly, lots more older people, people living longer, and age is a risk factor for dementia. And if you're going to do anything about dementia, you'd be as well catching it as early as possible. And why wouldn't you then study what's called normal cognitive aging, i.e. study those who are aging more or less well in thinking skills early on before they get dementia? And then, of course, we realized, well, actually, there's an opportunity to do this in following up the Scottish Mental Surveys, because one element that's almost always missing in studying normal cognitive aging is this: people's original cognitive ability scores. And again, I know this is a mix of lay and scientific audience, so a lay example would be the following. I used to practice as a doctor, I'm now a research psychologist, but if somebody came into my clinic and said, "I think I'm growing shorter," which we do as we get older, I would measure their height. And then I would say, "What height did you used to be?" I think that's perfectly obvious. But when it comes to cognitive function, lots of studies studying cognitive aging will simply measure people's cognitive functions. Now, you don't know then if somebody's got a low or a medium score, whether they were always low or medium, or whether they've dropped from some fairly fancy height. And so knowing people's original cognitive scores turns out to be a great advantage. And you've only got it in one place in the world, effectively, of people of this age anyway, and that's in Scotland. And so this is what I'm going to be calling their original or childhood or early life cognitive ability scores. See, we thought it was worth troubling some of these individuals who, to be honest, took a mental test at age 11 and then forgot about it for 40, 50, 60, 70 years, some of them. And then we went back and bothered them again. I'm going to show you them. Now, there were the Aberdeen birth cohorts as well that Lawrence led, but I'm going to talk about the ones that I've been leading with John Starr and originally Lawrence as well, the Lothian birth cohorts of 1921 and 1936. So I'm going to introduce you to some of these folk. So to get your head around the four numbers, I need you to remember the Lothian birth cohort of 1921, or born in 1921, and took part in the Scottish Mental Survey of 1932 when they were 11. And the Lothian birth cohort of 1936 took part in the Scottish Mental Survey of 1947. Oh, yes, and one other thing. For technical reasons, another really nice thing is when you're studying cognitive aging is to have everybody you're studying to be the same age. Because age itself tends to change cognitive functions, And if you happen to be studying a group of people who are all the same chronological age, isn't that interesting to find out how they've aged differently, even though they've lived the same number of years on the Earth? So these are the LBC 21 and 36, and these are where we recruited them from. They're not all from the Lothian area. This is the Lothian birth cohort 1921, so a few from the west and a few north and points south. But we have got a good representation of Edinburgh and Lothian from them. And here they are, some of them. These three ladies here are members of the Scottish Mental Survey. They took part at this study in age 11, and they never thought any more about it until we bothered them at age 79 and asked them to come back again. So they are the three of them in this picture at Portobello School in Edinburgh. And we recruited 550 around 1999, 2000. And we saw them at age 79, the 550 of them, and then at 83, and then at 87, then at 92. And my researcher, Alison Patty, has just brain scanned 52 people aged 92 in this last year or so. So we're still in touch with over 100 of the cohort, and 52 are well enough to come in for a brain scan just in the last year or so. So they are the Lothian birth cohort 1921. And the Lothian birth cohort of 1936, again, mostly from Edinburgh and the Lothian area, but some points west, north and south, but a good representation of Edinburgh, but not a full and representative sample by any means. And there they are at one of the gatherings before, when we measure them at each wave, as we call it, we bring them in every 3 years to test them. And before we publish the data, we have them in to tell them what we've been finding before it goes out to the scientific community. Andy recognised where we are there? Yeah, Church of Scotland Assembly Hall on the Mound. It's one of the few places in Edinburgh big enough to hold them and that we can afford. And here's one of them here, Mr. Simpson. So we recruited 1,091 of them, and here he was just around age 11, and we've seen them at age 70 when we saw 1,091, and then at 73, and they've just finished being in the field in 2013 at age 76. I put year 2012, but you'll appreciate, because this is all one-to-one testing and they each spend about a day and a half with us, it takes about 2.5 years to get through a wave of testing, and a lot of money as well. So what do we do with them, having brought them back after having taken part in these childhood mental ability tests when they were aged 11? Well, I used to have a long list of boring texts, but I've just reduced it to pictures now, which I think is better. So one thing is, this is the Lothian birth cohort of 1936, but it will serve well for both of them. We put them through with break 16 cognitive tests. So we basically try and wander around the brain, testing as many capabilities as possible. We ask them to undertake a brain scan, a structural magnetic resonance imaging brain scan to study their white and grey matter, which I'll talk about later. And that itself takes an hour and a quarter. It's a long time to stay very still, which they do for us. And then we do genetic testing as well. And this is one of the genetic tests that we've done, where each person's blood, their white cells, underwent 610,000 genetic tests. So each person underwent 610,000 genetic tests. I put these up here because these are the things that cost me millions of pounds when we're doing them. We also do sensory testing, a lot of physical testing. This is, for example, spirometry to test the lungs, anthropometry, we measure their bodies. This is a picture of the back of the eye. We take 9 little bottles of blood, as Tony Hancock would have said, very nearly an armful. Yeah, you're on the ball, well done. And then we cheat. We get another half day's work out of them by giving them or sending them a questionnaire before they come to the clinic, which means they can spend time at home filling out things about their social background, their quality of life, their personality, their home area, their diet, etc., etc. So we get a lot of information. So I think that's about it. Oh, yes, and we test them all at the Wellcome Trust Clinical Research Facility at the Western General Hospital in Edinburgh. So we have research nurses there, so I hire the space, and my psychologists who I train go down and test them for the cognitive functions. And it's just a brilliant place because we can get all our medical testing there, all the cognitive testing down there. The basement does the genetic testing as well, and the brain scanner's 2 minutes walk away, so it's just absolutely ideal place to go, and to get a parking space, which actually is the most difficult thing of all to do. And so just to show you that this is just me as a kind of a front man or anchor man for a whole team, it's just to show you that we're funded by Age UK and Age Scotland to do especially the 1936s that was called the Disconnected Mind Project. And the centre is funded by Lifelong Health and Wellbeing. But I have a number of people in the team who develop their own interests in the things that might contribute to healthy cognitive ageing. So things like how engaged are people, and I'm not going to read the names of everybody, but this is a credit to them, what people's lifestyle contribute, personality, quality of life and health. We have a lot of folk who work on genetics and on brain imaging and on the statistical methodology as well. So that's our home team, because everybody there is funded under grants that we have on the Lothian Birth Courts in 1921 and 1936. But we need more expertise. And I already said we work at the Wellcome Trust Clinical Research Facility, but we have expertise from geriatric medicine. And I've picked out John Starr, who's a co-director of the Lothian cohorts with me, Susie Schenken. We have more work on human genetics with Professor David Porteous chipping in. More expertise on brain imaging. Joanna Wardlow and Mark Baston are another two of the folks who look after the cohort with me. More emphasis on mood imaging and genetics, ophthalmology expertise, oxidative stress expertise, and cortisol. So we bring in, these are largely senior individuals from the University of Edinburgh to add to the cohort by way of bringing in expertise. And then when we can't find our expertise in Edinburgh, we go beyond Edinburgh, which of course is the world, and we get expertise on diet and nutrition from Aberdeen, biomarkers in Glasgow, blood-brain barrier from London, telomeres, immunology, proteomics, genome-wide association studies, and brain cortical thickness. So you can see that it ends up being kind of orchestrating a large team of individuals. And that's a word cloud, and it's just to show you the difficult job one has of getting across some of the results we've got. The Lothian cohorts of 1921 and 1936, and not us, the team, but the participants have been responsible for over 100 scientific articles to date. They've just been running over 10 years. That's not bad. And the bigger the typeface here, the more articles they've had in these journals. And the biggest typeface, I think, is 10, and the smallest one, 1. And I can't help my pointer wandering to a few places just to show the cohort off a wee bit. And for those of you who don't know, this is a rather in-house joke, that these are some of the world's top journals that the cohort have managed to wheedle themselves into with some of their results, which I'm going to present tonight, of course. And that's it, really. That is the cohort. Those are the Scottish Mental Surveys. And all I've got to do now is show you a few of their results. So any questions about why we bother these perfectly innocent older people who are only responsible for taking these studies? So those are the cohorts.
What prompted the initial work? Do you think there was any sense that it was going to come into use further down the line?
Good question. So the question is, what prompted the initial work? The Scottish Mental Survey of 1932 was undertaken because of a Carnegie Foundation conference that took place in Eastbourne, where researchers into education from Europe and North America and the United Kingdom gathered together, and they were worried. They were worried how we assess children, how we assess them at school, and how we assess them for various streams of education. And you know what they did? They gave each country a research job to do, and they had to come back in a few years' time and report back on what they'd done. And Scotland said, OK, we'll test these newfangled things called IQ tests, and we'll just test the entire country to find out how many people there are that will need special education, both at the top and at the bottom of the distribution. And I'll talk later about why they did the second one, because that's a very different story. But that's why they did the original one, and there was no conception. And it was really famous to begin with. It was the original mental survey of 1932 was translated into everything from Swedish to Zulu. So the book that came out in 33, and then the fact that folks like me hadn't heard of it all years later just showed you how much into obscurity it had gone. Yeah, there's a question there.
How did you find the people again all those decades later?
Thank you. It's a good question. How did we find the people again? Well, an interesting answer to that, with ethics permission, first thing. Okay, and it was done rather differently in Aberdeen and in Edinburgh. So this audience, probably a lot of hands will go up, but has anybody not heard of the Community Health Index? Well, okay, some of you haven't. The Community Health Index is a register of people who have a GP. And because almost everybody has a GP, and at that time the chief area medical officer in Edinburgh was Helen Zealy, and so we're not allowed to approach anybody, but we wrote to Helen Zealy and said, Helen, it'd be really good if you were able to tell people if they were born in a particular year, they might have taken this test, and we would quite like to see them for research. And she said, well, which people do you want? And we said, no, everybody, just everybody born in that particular year. And so there was no selection whatsoever. We didn't need to know anything about them. She just was kind enough to hand on a letter signed by me which said, you probably took part in this survey if you were born in this year and you were at school at Scotland at age 11. Would you like to get in touch with us? Because we want to do some stuff. And thousands got in touch with us. That was it. That's how we got in touch. So it was great. We didn't need to know anything. And we did do some advertising as well in the local press. Actually, I'm probably sort of giving too many asides here. But anyway, I shall. People got wind of the story. We put it in the Scotsman and other places in the evening news. And the Dundee Courier really liked the story. And they blooming well ran it. And we got 300 people wanting to take part from Dundee that we had no funding for and no transport. So we still have them untested. We did write back, of course, and filled them up about the Edinburgh work, but it just shows you the Sorcerer's Apprentice at work there. Well, by the way, I better say on camera, I'm not calling the Dundee Courier the Sorcerer's Apprentice. I can't afford the... Right, so factors that influence cognitive aging. So it's a myth that when Mrs. Beaton wrote her recipe for rabbit pie, the first thing she says is, first catch your rabbit. I checked. And actually, the first line of it is, one rabbit. That's all right. And so, first catch your rabbit in terms of finding factors that influence cognitive aging. Well, people say to me, of course they say all the time, what is the secret to having good cognitive function in older age? Is that a reasonable question? I mean, I gather that's what some of you will be here tonight to hear about. What's the secret, or what is a secret, to having good cognitive function in older age? Well, I'm afraid that's a rather boring answer. So let me just go back and say why I'm going to get to that answer. Right, so everybody asks me, and I'm not interested in the mean scores at different ages, and I hope that will become clear why. But people ask, and so I'm going to show you. So this, can you just see, this is the Lothian birth cohort of 1921. And this is their score out of 76 at age 11, 79, 87, and 90. And I've been careful to make this the same people. There's seats up here if you want. I'll not stand too closely. And so at age 11, they were getting an average score of 49. At 79... the scoring average of 63. This is on the Murray House test, 58. And even at age 90, they're not yet down to their age 11 scores. It's okay. So big surprise. Nobody's cognitive ability is finished developing at age 11, but people do tend to think that's an interesting result. Now, what I do want to show you is this. Now, first bit of statistics, and I'll apologize. If you take people's scores at age 11, and this is the Lothian birth cohort of 1921. And if you test them on the same test with the same instructions and the same time limit at age 79, almost 70 years later, the correlation between those two scores is 0.66. Now, for people, I know some people won't be using correlations every day. What that means is this, is that there is a tendency for in old age, the bright sparks at age 11 still to be the bright sparks in old age, the people in the middle still to be in the middle, and the people who don't score so well still to be scoring not quite so well. But it is not perfect. And I know the majority of the audience will be thinking in their head, God, that's rather patronizing, easy description of a correlation. I've already squared that correlation and worked out that 50% of the variance is actually stable from childhood to old age. Yes? Well, I'll just repeat that. If you square this, you get the percentage of people's differences that are stable from childhood to old age, and it's about 50%. That's a brilliant figure, because it means, and just I assume it was us, we were all tested at age 11, and we're all back at 79. It means that half of our differences in cognitive skills, as measured by this test, are stable from age 11 to age 80. But it also means 50% of people's differences are not stable, and there must be things that influence that, and we're trying to find them. So we don't really care about stability. Oh, by the way, if you fill all this in, the correlation between age 11 and age 90 is still 0.54. And I don't think anybody's ever going to do a longer follow-up of the same IQ test across the human lifespan, and that just is coming out this year. So that was the sort of rather poor joke, but that's the more interesting thing. And let's move on to what else. So first of all, social and lifestyle factors. So these are the sorts of things that we've looked at to see if they boost or bust your healthy cognitive aging. Does anybody want me to talk about any of these? Do you want to look down the list and see what you'd be quite fancy hearing about? Okay. Right. Okay. We've looked at all of these and we've published papers, and that's part of the problem. I can't come and give you the data on each of them. Well, one of the biggest contributions we found is from physical fitness. The healthy mind in the healthy body. And I'm usually going to be presenting stuff from the last year or so, and I'm going to be showing you some unpublished stuff. But I'm going to show you, this is about the oldest thing I'm going to show you, just because it's impressive. So physical fitness is how fast you can walk 6 meters, how strong you are on the dynamometer, and how much you can blow out on the spirometer over a second. And even if you've never done statistics, this has got a very simple story. How strong are the Lothian Berthcot's cognitive ability at age 79? And once you take into account their cognitive ability at age 11, their sex, their social class, and their genetic status, I'm not going to go into APOE just now because I'm going to mention it later, but once you take all of these into account and put them to one side, there's quite a fair contribution from being physically fit. So let me just put that in plain language. For these people born in 1921 and measured at about age 80, the ones who had better lung function, could walk a short distance faster, and could grip better, had better cognitive function than you would expect from their age 11 mental ability. So they had healthy cognitive aging, those who were physically fitter. And will I do this just now? No, I'll just tell you that. Is that all right? You get the idea. So being physically fitter. And what's really nice about that, what's absolutely magic, is effectively, for those of you who are looking at this, this is a linear regression. The effect sizes are not massive, but this is independent of cognitive function at age 11. That's the powerful ingredient here. Okay, I usually get a big rush to talk about alcohol, and I'm going to talk about alcohol. So what would people's guesses be about how alcohol contributes to healthy cognitive aging? Now, nobody in the Lothian Berthcots is a heavy drinker, okay? So don't even get that idea. Well, you've got a strong opinion by the look of it. Okay, fine. Good. Okay, so we've got a nice divergence of opinion. So maybe not so good. Maybe it is healthy. Maybe there's a middle road. So this is alcohol and cognitive aging, and I like to orient people. This is the Lothian Berthcot of 1936. And when I'm showing any statistics, I try always to show an empty table first, because once you've put numbers in, you've lost the audience. They all start looking at the bloody numbers, and you've got no control over them. Whereas if I've put no numbers in, I can actually tell you what's going on. That is, we measure general thinking skills, speed of thinking, and memory. So they're all quite simple, straightforward things, measured by lots of different tests. And for those of you who know about these things, this is an eta squared, so we're doing a general linear model, basically an Ankova-type model. But straightforwardly, if the next thing you see is in bold and it's got an asterisk, it means alcohol's got a significant effect. Okay, so a technical and a lay description there. It's an eta squared from an Ankova, but if you see a bold number and it's got an asterisk, it means alcohol does have an effect. So it does. It's not a big effect. Most of the things beyond childhood ability are not big effects. I emphasize that. But it is a significant effect on all of these mental skills. I've not told you the direction of effect. In every case, it is positive. The people who are drinking more alcohol have got better general thinking skills, faster processing speed, and better memory. Now, and this is Janie Corley's work. Do remind me to name check my team. This is Janie and the team. And Janie, because we were lucky and we were working with Geraldine McNeil in Aberdeen and we had a food frequency questionnaire, we could look in great detail at the types of alcohol people were drinking. I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. But you'll get this. This will become boring in a second. But we can look at this effect. So this is an effect of alcohol on thinking skill, and it's positive. It helps you think better. Now, what I'm going to do is rather contentious next. I'm going to contend that any other research team would have published it like that and said, there seems to be a positive effect of alcohol on these types of cognition. But we did one more step in our statistics. We then adjusted for people's ability score at age 11. Now, the next column of numbers I'm going to show you, if the numbers shrink, and especially if they don't appear bold any longer, and if they lose their asterisks, then all that effect is gone. Right, okay, I didn't change the font to non-bold. Okay, so, but it's almost all gone. So what's happened? This is what's happened. The interpretation a minute ago there was alcohol might be causally influencing better cognition, but it ain't. It looks like it might be this, that children with better general cognition scores at age 11 drink more when they're older. And also, if you don't adjust for age 11 IQ but adjust for social class, you get the same thing. So what's the story? It looked like it was about alcohol boosting healthy cognitive aging, but it probably is this. It's probably that the brighter children, I'm just making this up now, get more education, a more professional job, and they end up doing what professionals do, drinking red wine, listening to the Archers, reading the Guardian, you get the idea. And that might be the interpretation here. And in fact, Janie looked at it, and almost all of this effect is down to red wine. That's it, really. You had a question?
I just wondered if it was correlated with engagement.
I'm going to look at engagement in a minute.
Yeah.
I'm going to look at engagement as well. Okay. And I said I'd give you, as a sort of nice SOP, some unpublished work. So here's some unpublished work. You might have caught the stuff that was done in India recently where they found that bilingualism was protective against dementia. Well, the same researcher, Dr. Thomas Back, is in my department in Edinburgh, and he's a member of my centre. And Thomas said, could he give the Lothian birth cohort of 1936 a bilingualism questionnaire? So we did that, and we've asked them, when did they learn their second or subsequent languages? How often did they use them? And how many languages do they have? And we've looked at whether bilingualism or multilingualism contributes to healthy cognitive aging. So we've looked at when they became bilingual, how many languages, and how frequently they used them. Again, this is the Lothian birth cohort in 1936. And it's in revision at Annals of Neurology, but the referees are so nice, it's not going to have any problem. And we've looked at general thinking, memory, speed of thinking, vocabulary, and how fluent people are with their language. Is that all right? So I'm going to show you the effects. And it's not going to be numbers this time. So, being bilingual, it doesn't matter when you pick up your second language, you'll have better thinking skills. For people who pick up their language late, their second language late, they seem to be faster thinkers. And again, people who are bilingual or multilingual have got a better vocabulary. Now, this is in old age, adjusting for people's cognition when they were young. So I must emphasize again, it's not just that bilingual people are smarter, it's that they are smarter than you would expect given their cognition when they were children. So they're getting some sort of a boost, we might say. With regard to these, again, general ability, it doesn't matter how many extra languages, as long as you've got the one, vocabulary the same, but fluency was only benefited by people who had more than two extra languages. And when it came to frequency of use, whether you were an active or passive bilingual, a passive bilingual is somebody who has a second language, doesn't use it very much. General thinking doesn't matter, vocabulary doesn't matter, but for fluency, it seemed that people who were passively bilingual were more fluent. But generally speaking, general thinking skill was improved by any aspect of bilingualism. So just to make it simple, it seemed that from Thomas Back's work, and this is Thomas here, that in his work in India, bilingualism was protective against dementia. Here, in the first ever study to be able to control for people's original ability, it seems to be perhaps protective for healthy cognitive aging. Oh, we've got a really complicated interaction. It's quite interesting, but let's not go there. Okay, biomedical factors. So these are some of the, oh, wait a minute. Let me go back. All right. Can you see these asterisks here? I meant to flag them up. These are factors that looked like they were influencing cognitive aging, but they were subject to this reverse effect that we found on alcohol. So it looked like coffee drinkers were getting a boost to their cognitive aging. It looked like people who were taking a lot of B vitamins were doing well. It looked like slimmer people had healthier cognitive aging, but in every case, these effects disappeared once we controlled for a 45-minute IQ test taken 60 years previously. And we call that reverse causation or confounding. I don't know which it is, but it's one of those. Right. Where are we going? We're going to biomedical factors. So these are just some of the things we use. And that's something we published. Has anybody heard of cytomegalovirus infection? Some of you? Yeah. Okay. Lothian birth cohort, 1936. Two-thirds of them are infected with the cytomegalovirus. When did they pick it up? Childhood, probably. And why is it interesting? Because, again, it's fairly typical that two-thirds of people, when they were first tested around their 70s, were infected by this and probably picked it up in childhood. And as one grows older, the cytomegalovirus, or CMV, seems to draw the attention of your immune system more and more. It soaks up lots of its effort. And there were papers indicating that cytomegalovirus was a risk factor for accelerated cognitive aging, that if you were infected by it, you might have less good thinking skill in old age than you would expect. So we tested it. And this is the work of Alan Gow and Paul Moss's team in Birmingham. Alan's with us in Edinburgh, and Paul Moss's team are in Birmingham. And once again, a simple cytomegalovirus. We just coded them yes or no as to whether they were infected based on blood test. We looked at general thinking, speed of thinking, and memory. Same rules apply. If this is significant, it'll have an asterisk. And for two of them, it was. They're not big effects. They're small effects. But what did we find? We found that people infected with the cytomegalovirus had less good thinking skills for general and for memory. But if you adjust, I'm not going to do age 11 IQ first, I'm going to adjust for childhood overcrowding, because we've got quite a lot of information about these people's social backgrounds as well. And it almost all disappears. So if you adjust this association between being infected by the cytomegalovirus and cognitive function, because it looks quite interesting. It looks like we found another factor that might be affecting cognitive aging. But adjust for their social status or their social background 60 years earlier, and it goes. And of course, it's about the same for age 11 IQ. And of course, it won't be a surprise, because that and that are correlated. I'm not going to say why they're correlated. I think it's a moot point, but they are. But you can adjust for these childhood factors, and this tantalizing association disappears. Right, okay. People often ask, is there any sort of take-home message for this? And if you've heard, did any of you come to Bruce McEwen's lecture here? So he would have talked about allostatic load, and we've worked with Bruce McEwen a bit, and we've tried to measure allostatic load in the Lothian birth cohort of 1936. What's a better term for allostatic load, something more accessible? Yeah, or wear and tear. That's what it says in Wikipedia, anyway. Okay, I looked it up before I came. So allostatic load, wear and tear. It's basically when your body gets a bit manky, okay, and possibly mankier than you would want it to be or would expect. And what's it based on? Well, a body that's got a high allostatic load would have a lot of inflammation on board. It would be prone to the metabolic syndrome. You're all aware of that, being a bit heavy, having a relatively poor glucose tolerance, having high blood pressure, having a disadvantageous lipid profile. So we measure all of this in the Lothian birth cohort. And this is a not friendly slide, but these are inflammation factors. These are lipids and glucose and body mass index and blood pressure. And very simply, what we're finding in our Lothian birth cohort of 1936 is this. The people who tend to have more inflammation on board also tend to have a poorer metabolic profile, also tend to have high blood pressure. And that is allostatic load. And that's not just hand waving. That's not just a diagram with arrows. These are numbers. When you measure these things in 1,000-odd older people, they go together. So if your body's more inflamed, it's also got more lipids that you don't want, it's got higher blood pressure, it's got more glycosylated hemoglobin, i.e. more likely to have type 2 diabetes, and it's got a disadvantageous body mass index. And these all go together, and you can correlate them and say, overall, people have got more or less allostatic load. Does that make sense? It's putting together some of these things that we measure and saying, isn't that interesting? The person who's got one disadvantageous measure tends to have a whole load of others. Now, it's not deterministic. It's a tendency. So when you tend to be scoring poorly on one of these things, you tend to be scoring poorly on the others as well. And does this, so we can give each person a score on allostatic load. And does it have any influence on anything? Well, allostatic load is associated with people's total brain volume. People with more allostatic load have got a more shrunken brain from brain scanning, and they've got lower general cognitive function. And that's a reasonable start for saying it might be important, and that's exactly what Bruce McEwen predicts in his research. And that's just coming out in Neurobiology of Aging, and it's Thomas Booth in the team that's been doing that. Right, let's move on to brain imaging. So when we decide to do brain imaging, I feel it's fairly obvious that the brain is the organ of thinking, unless you believe the immaterial mind is doing thinking, in which case I don't know how to test that, but I know how to test the brain. And especially we're interested in white matter integrity. This is the actual brain scanner that we use, the 1.5 Tesla GE scanner. And Joanna Wardlow is the lead on the brain imaging side of things. And this is just to show you, if you wondered why you're sticking people in a brain scanner for an hour and a quarter, it's because we want to do what's called multimodal structural brain imaging. We want to test the brain in as many different ways as possible, and so we get all of these different things. I'm going to show you just a couple. So, for example, the team, especially led by Maria Valdez Hernandez, worked out a new way of actually showing people's iron deposits in the brain. Why would we be interested in that? Because iron gets deposited in the brain. It's not a good thing. I'm not an expert on this, but it's partly thought to be to do with very small bleeds that would never otherwise be detected. And what did we find in this paper that we reported a couple of years ago? We found the following. We found that people with more iron deposited in their brains had slightly less good cognitive function and slightly less good than you would expect given their childhood mental ability. So in other words, more iron was influencing cognitive aging negatively. It was a bad thing to have. But also, there was an interesting thing as well. The children who'd scored better at age 11 had less iron in their brain at age 73. So we got two effects. Not that one wiped the other out. We got an effect of iron on cognitive aging, but also an effect of childhood cognition on iron deposition that didn't entirely wipe out the effect of iron deposition on cognitive ability. Is that clear? I rather wound my way around that a bit. And this is one of the main things we're after. This is, again, if you look at me for a second, this is as if you're looking straight onto my brain from the front. So this is top, this is bottom, these are the sides here. And that's the big bit that joins the two halves of the brain called the corpus callosum. So that's the corpus callosum. And can you see all that looks a bit hairy? That's us imaging the white matter of the brain. So first of all, the colours are, of course, false. But this is not a cartoon. This is real data. This is how well we can image somebody's white matter. This is a single person, a member of our research team. As you see in early middle age, they did ask me to make it late youth, but I think this is more accurate. And that's how well you can see in a single person the white matter of the brain. And this is one of the Lothian birth cohort, 1936, at age 73. Can you spot any difference? Don't hang about. There's a big obvious difference. Yeah. They've collected some white matter hyperintensities. It used to be called white matter lesions. So this hairy stuff here is the white matter of the brain. Now, everybody's heard of the gray matter. What's the white matter? The white matter is the hundreds of billions of connections in your brain. If you put the connections, your gray matter only works because it's all wired up together. Okay, simple as that. If you put these connections together in this brain, it would go around the world four times at the equator. So it's as connected as that. And it's got, as I say, hundreds of billions of connections in old age as well. And the most amazing thing is you can actually measure. Can you just look up here just now, these slices? So these ones, if you just look here, being sliced like that. And these ones, it's almost as if you've taken a cleaver down the middle of the head. We can measure the integrity of all the main connecting white matter areas in the brain. So what's an easier way to describe that? Imagine Britain's roads. There are some motorways, there are some A roads and B roads. And basically the brain is like that. It's got motorways and A roads of connection. We can actually measure for each person how many blocked roads there are, how many potholes there are. In other words, whether the white matter, like any other connection, is beginning to tear, is beginning to lose its insulation. And we can put a number on it between 0 and 1. 1 is better and 0 is less good. And basically what we published, and Lars Penke in the group was leading this and came out just over a year ago, was the following, that in the Lothian birth cohort of 1936, one of the largest samples tested using this method, the people who had better connections in the brain had better thinking skills in older age, above and beyond what you would expect for their cognitive function in childhood. So if you ask me what's another clue to healthy cognitive aging, it's keeping good white matter connections in your brain, keeping your brain so that its wiring is still intact and still accurately and quickly passing messages from one area of the brain to the next. Physical fitness again. Oh, actually, you were asking about engagement earlier. Yeah. Well, when we did a study of engagement, that's the top paper there. I'm going to come back to brain imaging in a second. We did study three types of engagement. We studied intellectual engagement with quite a long questionnaire, social engagement, and physical engagement, whether you actually do go out and take exercise. And only one of those three was associated with better cognitive aging. Physical engagement. And it's really important that, because what we found was, with regard to intellectual engagement, that was something that, yes, bright people in old age do tend to do more of, but that was all explained by their childhood IQ. So bright children end up being brighter and more intellectually engaged. It's not that intellectual engagement is boosting, in our study, cognitive aging. But what we did find was that people who were reporting taking more physical exercise were doing better in cognitive function, but also with regard to the brain. And this was a surprise. Again, Alan Gow, I credit here. So this is reported physical activity and brain aging, both with regard to how good the white matter was and the shrinking of the brain. And both of these are small effects, but significant. So let me just explain what this is. People who report to us that they are more physically active don't just get better scores on cognitive tests, they've got better looking brains. Their brains are better connected, and they've retained more of their grey matter as well. So that's much harder evidence than just cognitive function. I can't believe a psychologist has just said that. Okay, right, okay. And if you adjust for age 11 IQ, look, it doesn't go away. If you adjust for age 11 IQ, social class, disease, it still mostly is there as well. All right. Now, here's a bit of fun. This is, again, I credit Sharif Karama here in Montreal, at the Montreal Neurological Institute. And he said, Ian, you're doing all this stuff with your brain imagers on white matter, okay? Why aren't you looking at gray matter? Well, we are looking at gray matter, but they have a special technique whereby they can measure the thickness of your brain's cortex. Is the brain's cortex a new phrase to anybody? Okay, good. You're handy, actually. I could have planted you. Right. If you think about what the brain is, it's a thinking machine that's got its gray matter on the outside. And what they do in Montreal is they say, actually, the brain is only the shape it is to get it inside this box. If you actually look at what it is, it's a big flat sheet of cling film. So the surface of the brain, once you take away all the folds, is a big flat sheet. And that flat sheet has got a few millimeters of gray matter. So your gray matter isn't massively fat, but look at me for a second, it covers the surface of the brain. And what they can do is they can measure the thickness of the gray matter mathematically right over the brain. No, so you're already looking at this and you're seeing, you all see this is a brain, yep. And you can see there are yellow and you can see there are red areas. Let me tell you what they are, because you've got to get ready for the next slide. The yellow and red areas of the brain are areas where, if the cortex is thicker, people have got better thinking skills. So if you're asking me, you've told me already about white matter, that's a good thing to keep healthy, so is the brain's cortex, because in all these red and yellow areas, there's an association between having a thicker brain cortex and better thinking skills, especially general cognition. And this is Lothian Bruthcourt, 1936, and this is about 600 people. Now what I'm going to do is, I'm going to ask, and this is all done, the thinking is at age 73, and the brain imaging is at age 73, and it's Lothian Bruthcourt, 1936. The next thing I'm going to do is, I'm going to adjust for age 11 IQ. And I'm going to say, sounds a bit unlikely, but these associations could be down to how smart children were 60 years ago. So let's see how many of these areas are left once you adjust for age 11 IQ. Note. So we would contend, and you know, contentious is contentious. We would contend any other study would have said, oh, this is exciting. Retain a thicker cortex, you've got better healthy cognitive aging. Mm-mm. It seems to be confounding. And that's why we called the paper that. And it got massive press attention, and they didn't understand it. Because not only were we talking about a correlation, we're talking about a correlation then confounded by a third variable, so it's quite hard to get across. You all got it? Okay, good. However, we're just about, and again, this is unpublished. We haven't even sent this away for publication. We've just got a first draft ready. Let me show you the areas of the brain's cortex that are thinner if you're a smoker. None of this is confounded. We cannot get rid of this. I'm going to tell you the punchline to begin with. Wow. So this is never smokers minus current smokers in Lothian Bruthcourt. Those are all the areas of the brain where the cortex is thinner for the people who are smoking. This is never smokers minus ex-smokers. It's not quite so much, but still lots. and this is ex-smokers minus current smokers. I don't know if you can all see it, because I know this is slightly low down, but this is the cortical thickness of never smokers, and then down to ex-smokers, and then down to current smokers. So people who are smoking and were smoking have got thinner grey matter in the brain. And we've looked at the number of years over which people have given up, and even over about 20 years, the recovery is not complete, unlike for, say, cardiovascular disease. So it's a striking new finding, not out yet. I'm going to finish then on genetics. Now, I know, strictly speaking, that's been an hour, but I've been taking some questions, and I'll invite people to keep throwing questions in, but we'll have some time for questions, and you will finish sharp at 6. So in genetics, we do two types of things. We look for genes that already seem to be interesting, and then we also just forget about hypotheses and go and search for hundreds of thousands of genetic effects as well. In fact, I said earlier, my 2006 is my oldest slide. This is my oldest slide because it's quite a beautiful slide. Anybody not heard of ApoE? Fine? Right. Apolipoprotein E. It's a gene. How many genes do humans have, roughly? It's one of 20,000-ish, probably a bit fewer than that. Okay, that's how many genes we've got. So it's one gene. What have people who've heard of ApoE, cheers, Helen. Why is ApoE interesting, apolipoprotein E? Yeah, it's got a small, it conveys a small increased risk of getting dementia of the type that's often called Alzheimer's over the age of 65. Did I say small? So I don't want people to get overexcited. And about a quarter of the people in this room have got the type called E4. So if you chose your parents unwisely, you've got an E4 flavor of this gene. And three quarters of the people, I don't know mine, I've never had it tested. Three quarters of the people do not have an E4. And I'm going to, again, I'm off my beat here, but I'm going to simplify because you've got to tell people something. Why might it confer? It's got something to do with cholesterol transport and probably to do with repair of nerve cells as well. And if I put it terribly simply, it might be something along the lines of, if you get, I don't know, I'm just pointing at you, okay? Or you. If you're one of the folks that gets the E4, it's a bit like getting a motor mechanic that only works on a Friday afternoon when he's desperate to get off home. And if you don't get E4, you've got a better mechanic who's fresh and wanting to do a good job for you. So let's think of it as brain mechanic. You get a more or less good brain mechanic. Can you imagine at age 11, your brain might not have needed much repair? I think it's arguably the case that by 79 you might have needed more repair to the brain. So this is why this is such a nice slide. Now please look at where the pointer is. This is for the Murray House test, the 45-minute test. This is the Lothian birth cohort of 1921. And this is when they took it at age 11. This is at age 79. And this is a standardized IQ score with an average of 100. And can you see, I've separated the groups into people who did not get the E4 version of the gene and those who did. Is that all right? So there's two groups. And all I want you to spot is this. At age 11, there is no difference in IQ between the quarter that have got E4 version of the gene and the three quarters that haven't. Is that okay? But by age 80 almost, there's a significant difference. So when people ask me about the genetics of intelligence, it's so nice to say that it's not even the same thing at different human ages. Because here's a genetic influence on human cognition that exists in old age that is not present in youth. So in other words, another contributor to healthy cognitive aging is avoiding getting the E4 version of apolipoprotein E. It is a small effect. Okay, that's that. So, but you probably remember me saying earlier, we keep bothering these cohorts, bringing them back to see them again. And so we've seen the Lothian birth cohort 1921 from 79 all the way through to almost 90. And so we looked at their memory. And here's the group here that do not have the E4, and that's how their memory functions from 79 to almost 90. And that's a group with E4. Can you see the difference? It's significant. So what I want to tell you is two things. That in terms of lifetime cognitive aging, from childhood up to 79, this genetic influence has a small effect. It is significant. And thereafter, across the ninth decade of life, this gene also has a detectable effect. And this is not dementia. We left out everybody with any hint of dementia. And for those of you who know about it, mini mental state examination score of 24 or less. And I'm going to come on to my very last thing, is this monster when we did 610,000 genetic tests. So I'll quickly say what this has given us. You all know that cognitive ability is quite controversial when it comes to genetics. And partly that's down to the fact that a lot of the work is done on twin studies, which I'm not critiquing, and adoption studies, because they all bring with assumptions. But to summarize disgracefully, testing on hundreds of thousands of DNA markers has allowed us to make an estimate of the genetic contribution to people's differences in cognition without resorting to twin studies or adoption studies, just using DNA testing. And we were lucky enough, Gail Davies and the team led this, to be the first study in the world that actually reported the estimated heritability of cognition in older age just based on DNA testing, nothing to do with families or twins or adoption. And Gail estimated that between 40 and 51% of people's differences in cognition. Let me just say again, this is not, if you think of it as a kind of a jar filling up, it's not 40 or 50% of your cognition. It's 40 to 50% of the differences between people in cognition that seem to be down to genetic influences. And what we've measured here, again, for those of you who want to know these things, is common single nucleotide polymorphisms, those that exist in 5% or more of individuals. We then did something, again, that we published in Nature last year, beginning at the end of 2012, where we looked at, well, you know, I'm interested in how much cognition changes from childhood to old age. And because we'd done all these genetic tests, it allowed us to make a broad estimate of how much of the changes between childhood and old age are down to the environment and how much of the changes are down to genes. And the basic answer from this paper, 75% of changes in cognition seem to be down to the environment, and only a minority, 25%, down to cognition, down to genetics. And the ApoE poked up again in that. And I think I shall finish on this just to tie up with somebody else. You had an epigenetics speaker here as well. And one of the things I've just blown £400,000 on is having the Lothian birth cohorts of 1921 and 1936 tested for epigenetics. So you know that genetics, or the genome, is what you get from your parents, and it doesn't change throughout your lifetime. However, that's not true with epigenetics. How shall I phrase it? It's all very well saying you've got all these genes, but along the genes, you get these methyl groups attached to bases. And basically, it's like having hundreds of thousands of switches on your genome that can switch genes on and off. So we measured 450,000 of these switches on every one of the Lothian birth cohort of 1921 and 1936 at each time we tested them. So we're testing it longitudinally as well. And we've just sent off our first result from this, and it's this. It's DNA methylation age and survival from 79 to 90. Let me just explain. If you look at your genome, if I take your DNA and stretch out the 3 billion base pairs, there's going to be a certain amount of those pairs have got these little groups attached, these switches attached. Now, what's interesting is the older we get, the more of these switches we get. So much so that you've got two ages, each of you. You've got a chronological age, and you've got a methylation age. Your DNA might be older or younger than you. And so what we did is, we said in the Lothian birth cohorts, let's look at whether the difference between people's chronological age and methylation age affects how long they live. Our prediction was that people with an older methylation age than their actual years of being on the earth would die sooner. Shall we see if it's true? So, here's quartile 1, the young methylation age. Can you look where I am at first? So this is 79, when we first saw the Lothian birth cohort of 1921. And this is age 92, when we last saw them. And this is the probability of surviving. So it's reasonable to say they were all alive when we saw them to begin with. Okay. And this is the death profile. We're all going to die. And they're very kind. They gave us permission to be informed about when they die in this cohort. And this is the youngest methylation age. And that's how they die. And that's the people with the oldest methylation age. And they are dying sooner. So, we've picked up a new indicator of human mortality. How old people's DNA looks on the basis of whether it's collected more or fewer methylation groups. And again, just to give credit where it's due, this is Riccardo Marioni with our Brisbane collaborators here. And fingers crossed, science are just currently reviewing this just now. We'll see what they think. But it's a new predictor of mortality based on epigenetics. And that's me, really, except to say that I'm not that daft. I know when we get older, cognition isn't the only thing we're thinking about. We want to be healthy. We want to have a good quality of life. And we did ask. We do always ask them about these things. And I'll just show you one little thing. This is our very last person tested at age 90 in the Lothian birth cohort of 1921. He gave permission to let me show him here. And this is from the Ed Diener Satisfaction with Life scale. And this is a question which says, I am satisfied with my life. Disagree, slightly disagree, neither agree nor disagree, slightly agree, agree, or strongly agree. And can you see that at age 90, all the responses almost are over at this side of life? Of course, you can say, well, actually, it's all very well for them. They're in this nice study, etc. But anyway, the people we're studying are satisfied with their life at age 90. So thanks. Obviously, as I said before, I'm just the sort of talking head on this one, but the Lothian birth cohorts in 1921, 1936, this is a couple of reunions. My gang, they're not all here, but it serves John Starr, John Wardlow, Mark Baston, and some of the team, some of the folks you heard publications from there. Funders, Pickett Especially Aid UK, Chief Scientist Office, and the MRC carried the brunt of a lot of what I was presenting tonight. And if you fancy any papers and want to get in touch with me, I will reply. I'm easy to find because I've got a funny name. And that's me there. And thanks very much. That's it. I'll take questions.